Let's make a deal. The $10,000 pyramid and the big showdown will not be seen today so that we may bring you the award presentations.
Live from New York City, the second annual
Platts Diane's Retro Awards.
Presentations. The National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Awards for Outstanding Artistic and Technical Achievement in Daytime Television. Starring your hosts, Monty,
Jason, and Brian.
Ladies and gentlemen, your hosts.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me as always is Jason.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year. We're another year older, Jason.
And you don't look a day over 2013.
You know what? I feel a little older, and I'm thinking maybe we ought to get a little more mature this year. Start with some light jazz.
You know what I say to that?
No? You don't want to wear a turtleneck and a sport coat?
Well, I am wearing a turtleneck. Actually, I'm wearing a... What do you call? Not a mock turtleneck, but just the turtleneck.
Oh, a dickie.
A dickie.
Which is fun to say.
Yes, yeah. I'm actually wearing a dickie. Thank you very much.
We had an ugly sweater party, Christmas sweater party last year. And I did the Randy Quaid, like I bought a tight-fitting white sweater and then purposely cut a black turtleneck to look like an ill-fitting dickie.
Love it.
Mm-hmm. So we're starting off great here. What we're doing this year is something that I have done annually on the blog, which is the 2014 Plaid Stallions Retro Awards, which is awarding things that at one point but now we, think evoked the retro spirit or were in themselves retro products. And as a little bit of an addition to our awards show, I did not get to do the retro awards last year. My first couple of months of the year were terrible. In spring, I went back to having a kid in the hospital. It just wasn't going to work out. So we are allowing things to overlap a little bit from last year and give some credit where credit's due, where I really wanted to give retro awards to things and just couldn't.
People have been waiting. They want to hear your views, and they value them. So,
I'd also like to start with – you know, this is an award show. The 70s were big with award shows. If you were to cast your ideal 70s award show, living or dead, who would you put in it?
Wow. Okay, let me just back up a second here. You're asking me if I were to cast – you mean the who would host such
a – Well, no, host and presenters. You know, like who would be important to that? You know how like those things just – those just things had a litany of stars.
Yeah. And you're saying for this particular subject matter.
Yeah. If this was the Plaid Stallions award show and you could bring back anybody from the dead or still remaining, who would you have? Cause I've got a short list. You want to hear mine?
Well, I'm going to throw one out to you. Sure. First off, that is an outstanding question.
It's almost a topic.
It really is. It's a great effing question because, you know, guys like you and I, we could spend a day and a half. The first name that comes to mind, nothing to do with the subject matter, unfortunately, but only because I really feel like he was the king. It was Johnny Carson.
Oh, wow. I go way lowbrow.
Johnny Carson was the king of late night, but he also was a fantastic host of the Oscars.
Okay.
And he just knew what was going on. He was very hip. You know, people forget that he kind of had a hipster vibe. Even though he looked a little bit older, he was no dummy. You know, he, you know, he liked jazz and
I just watched a really great documentary about him.
Yeah, it's really good, isn't it? It's called King of Late Night, I think it's called.
I was influenced by him a little bit as a kid. I mean, obviously he was kind of getting into his twilight even in the early 80s, but I watched Johnny Carson.
Well, is that the documentary with The Price is Right, I can't believe I can't think of his name.
Drew Carey. Perhaps,
And he talks about being invited over to the couch.
Yeah.
What that meant. And he starts getting choked up when he tells the story.
Well, yeah, that was,
That was so great. That was so well done. So for the subject matter itself, though, I'm going to say the Hudson Brothers. I don't know.
You know what? You say that, and this brings up another story. The other day, I was going through some plumbing supplies and things I picked up at Canadian Tire, which is a retail chain here. Right. And I pull out of the bag, I kid you not, a DVD of the Hudson Brothers Razzle Dazzle out.
Are you joking?
And I went, what? And I realized that, like, at the cash registers at Canadian Tire, they have DVD, closeout DVDs.
Tell me you bought it, please.
And I did.
Oh, send it to me.
It was like I went, I got to have this, and then forgot completely about it. So then,
send it to me, please.
Yeah, because I actually kind of worried about myself, like that I spent $4 without thought, and then thought, well, why would I? I'd never sit, like, you know, other than that my wife is terrified of the emu puppet that was on that show, I can't think of any reason to sit through that.
Was it Rod Hull?
Rod Hull and Emu, yeah.
That guy terrified me. He was
did
so
you ever
brutal.
See him on The Tonight Show with
Richard really hurt
Pryor?
He, like, physically hurt people.
All I remember is on The Tonight Show, the emu started eating out of Richard Pryor's hair. Which was one of the biggest laughs I think that he got.
But can I say, if people at home haven't already sort of dropped their bowl of cereal, what do you think the odds are that I mention, as a joke, I pull the Hudson Brothers out of my beehole?
And I bought the DVD a week ago?
And you bought a DVD a week ago. Do you know how infinitely improbable that sort of thing is?
Well, I think that's probably why I bought it, because it was like, this exists? and it just was. I honestly don't remember doing it. I was trying to fix the toilet downstairs.
Well, when you get in the when you get locked into the Hudson Brothers black hole, there's no escape.
Yeah,
you just go with it and let it happen.
I actually have a receipt that says Flow Valve Hudson Brothers Razzle
Dazzle. Oh my God! Please put that on Facebook. That's brilliant. I want it. Or burn it for me, please. I haven't. That is a show that I truly have not seen since it aired.
Well, let me make this promise to you on air. You can have it when I'm done with it, which will be very quickly.
Okay.
And I will mail it to you, and you explain it to Diane.
All right, will do.
Hervé Villechaize would be one of my presenters.
Well, yeah, give me your short list of presenters. This is your short list of presenters for the Pod Stallions Retro Awards.
Hervé Villechaize, Joe Flynn.
And if you're making the monkey the vice principal. Yeah.
Vic Tayback. Huge fan.
He just looks like a rapist.
No, I've never equated that to Vic Tayback. I'm sure his grandchildren would be thrilled with your
covered
assessment.
Covered in grease, working behind the counter, angry at women.
He looks like, he looks misogynistic.
Now let's get over here. I'll break your face.
Rudy Ray Moore, because I adore Rudy Ray Moore.
You change the tone of the awards show. I think it might get a little racy.
Oh, they probably would have to, you know, do a tape delay on him.
3 second delay, yeah.
3 second delay, because it might get a little blue.
Rudy Ray Moore
and Mr. Carlin from the Bob Newhart show.
Oh, Bob! Hey, what's No, wait, not, no, no, not, no, that's the neighbor.
Yes.
Wait, what was the neighbor called? He was it Larry?
No, oh my God, the guy that walked in all the time. He had a sitcom in Canada for a while.
He was brilliant. That was a brilliant cast, but he was a pilot, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He got more action than anybody on the show, except for the dentist. Peter Boners, by the way.
Peter Boners, director now.
But when he'd come in, I remember when he'd always come in Bob's, oh, hey, Bob, hope I didn't get you at a bad time. You know, he's always but Carlin was just deadpan. He was brilliant. You know what? I'm going to go with him. That's my host. Him and Villachez.
Villachez. Oh, yeah. Then they could have all those little short jokes. That would be awesome. Yeah.
That won't get old.
Nope.
Tell me you've seen the footage of Villachez on the Mike Douglas show singing, "Why do people have to be," or whatever, something about people being mean to each other.
Yeah, he had a real utopia thing going on.
He did, and he had a recording career.
Yeah, I know he did. He was an interesting cat. I'm a huge fan of him from Fantasy Island, but he's really funny in what's that Henry Winkler movie, the one and only? Carl Reiner, Henry Winkler movie.
God, you are pulling stuff out of your butt.
Yeah.
Well, you know what else he was? He was one of the henchmen in Man with the Golden Gun.
Knick Knack.
Knick Knack.
I think that's what really set his career off.
In a 50-year lifespan of very politically incorrect things in the Bond film, the things they do to him toward the end of that movie are probably like right in the top 10 of wrong things. It's so inappropriate. It's just, it's awful. But as usual, it wouldn't be an episode of Pod Stallions if we hadn't gone completely off the rails in the first 5 minutes.
I think, yeah, you know what? We can tie this all in together. Okay. Our first category for the Retro Awards is our top picks for theatrical movies this year. And these are films that are either embody a retro spirit. Well, they're all going to just embody a retro spirit, or they're remakes or that sort of thing. Because really, we can't say 70s movies because they don't exist on the movie theaters anymore.
Right.
And my top pick would be the latest Planet of the Apes film, which I, for the life of me, can't remember the name. Is it Dawn or Rise?
I think it's Goin' Ape.
Goin' Ape, that's it. Yeah. Yeah, that's with Tony Danza and Danny DeVito, isn't it?
They might as well, because I can't remember the damn things. The first one, I think, was called Rise.
Was it
Rise of the Planet of the Apes?
We are. You know, and I worked hard on this, too, and I can't remember. Yeah, I did research, I wrote notes, and
okay.
The reason, no, it's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
This one's Dawn.
Yeah, Rise was the last one, and I apologize.
That's what I said. That's what I meant. The first one was Rise. This one's Dawn.
So the reason I like it is I love the original Planet of the Apes movies. They can do no wrong, and I've gotten in arguments with people who say, oh, all the sequels suck. No, I love them even more than the original because they're more fun. They're goofier. The longer it gets, the more fun they're having with it. And yeah, there's no logic, and don't try to dissect Gossamer and put a timeline to this. So when you asked me, and not many people did, but if somebody asked me, can you remake Planet of the Apes and not do it campy and get people to give a crap about it, I'd say no. I think they're just left to time. So the fact that I have walked into, you know, 3 years ago I walked into Rise of the Planet of the Apes and was blown away by how well done it was. You know, there was a couple of little nods, but straightforward, well done film. I was really worried that you just can't sequel that without, you know, getting goofy, and they managed to pull it off. It's an interesting film. You care about the apes. You care about the people. It has nods to, you know, Battle for the Planet of the Apes and a little bit of Beneath in there. There's little things, but it's just a compelling and well-done film that doesn't crush under its own continuity or try to please too many people. And well done. I can't believe that there are two Planet of the Apes films this good out there.
That's the thing, is the first one was such a surprise because, you know, I think we sort of had a bad taste in our mouths from the Tim Burton one.
Yeah, and you know, I don't even that's what I was expecting anyone to do with it, is camp it up. You know, the Tim Burton one is terrible, but it's not a surprise because it's a weird subject matter to work with.
know? Yes, and it really, as good as the script is and as far away as it tries to get from the original Apes, you know, it's trying to be its own thing. It gives nods and winks, but it really is a reinvention in a very unique way. First off, I had a tough time watching that first one because it kills me. It just, when he gets sent to the monkey house and and draws that window, oh, man.
I won't let my daughter watch it. Not because it's got anything. It's just that, like, we went to see the Wolfman, the Lon Chaney Wolfman this year at Halloween at the theaters. And when the lights came up, she was bawling, you know. We're gonna wait on the old Planet of the Apes thing, you know. Very sympathetic person.
It's too much. I'm just not built for it. And there's even moments in this one that get me too. But it really, and I've said this before, probably not on this show, but first off, so much of it rests solely on the motion capture acting and forgetting that you're looking at animated, you know, characters, much the same way it was with Gollum. When you go back and watch, you know, Phantom Menace, or let's say any of the prequels, because you just never forget you're looking at a big rubbery, you know, computer game looking thing, and someone's looking in just a bit over its head or just to the right or left. It just doesn't work. You go back and look at Lord of the Rings, Two Towers particularly, because that's what really knocked people out. It's such amazing work, but it's Andy Serkis. If this was another universe, he would have been nominated for Best Supporting Actor. He probably would have won. He would have been nominated for King Kong, for the first Apes movie. People get nominated for wearing a false nose, or, you know, John Hurt got nominated as the Elephant Man back in 1980, and that was a big prosthetic head. But there's still this stigma for some reason about this motion capture technology and just what people can pull off. But it is extraordinary. To me, it's no different than if he was standing there with bits of prosthetic on his face. Incredible. And I think more than that, even, I think he inspires everyone around him. I picture him on set, you know, guiding people, you know, helping them. And he is the king of motion capture, Andy Serkis.
Absolutely.
And I feel like his intensity and his craft sort of affects everyone around him, and they all raise their game, sort of. But he's the king. I mean, and no pun intended, but go back and look at King Kong even, which I think is a mess. It's beautifully done, but it's too much of a good thing.
I couldn't get through that.
But just the ape, if you could just edit down, you know, an hour's worth of footage of that ape, it is extraordinary.
It looked brilliant. You're right. Oh. It was just like attacking you when you were watching it.
It was merciless. It never sort of let up. That's good though. That's a good pick. That would be on my list. And you know, it's funny. I own both of them. I own all the Apes films, even the Burton film. These are really works of art. These new ones, but difficult to watch. It's not the kind of movie. I'd love the next one to be, you know, the cardinal rule is, you know, ape not harm ape. Don't kill ape. But I'd love the next one to be like different factions of apes really going at it and leaving the humans out, because you always feel like, you know, there's a human. And as soon as you see a human, you go, they're going to fuck something up. They're going to press the wrong button or kill a monkey, and the whole thing's going to kick off. And, you know, that it makes me a bit anxious. But if we're going to go this route, because I'm new to the Retro Awards, this is your bag.
You know what? As long as you can back it up with a good argument, there's no wrong answer.
I think I can.
Okay.
Because, and I'm going to have a 5-minute explanation as to why. My pick was a little thing called Guardians of the Galaxy.
I completely agree.
From Marvel. And
it's a small film, I heard.
A little film. And I got a million reasons, but I'll try to make it quick. I think I speak for most of us. When it was first announced, where we went, what? And then followed it up with, oh, I see. Because it immediately you just went, I know what they're doing. They're really pushing the boat out now. And what they're saying is, you know, you can have your Christopher Nolan world where it was kept grounded and there was no, you know, mystical fancy pants stuff to it. Well, before long, you know, by the time you get to the Avengers and you've got these creatures coming through a wormhole, which they really beautifully address in Iron Man 3 with his PTSD, like, whoa, there's another universe out there. Well, this was going to open the door for that very thing, for Marvel to say, there is a, you think the Marvel world is big, you ain't seen nothing. The Marvel world is enormous, and we've just opened the door to the space, you know, science fiction, whatever you want to call it, to that aspect of the Marvel universe. Now you're going to see it all start to tie in from all different corners. But Guardians, again, wouldn't have been the first pick. You'd think maybe Doctor Strange or something else that would take us into the science, you know, spacey sort of realm. And then as it started to move on, you heard names like James Gunn and Chris Pratt, you kind of went, oh, I think I know what this tone is. But even that couldn't have prepared me for how much I loved this movie and how good I thought it was. I own it on DVD. I think I've watched it about six times now. Sometimes, you know, beginning to end. Sometimes it's just sort of on and I'm doing other stuff, but it's there. And so I've really, you know, picked through it. And of course you can rip it to pieces as you can most of these Marvel things. You just have to go with it.
I think want to not like it, I guess.
Yeah. I think the world was kind of thinking, oh, you know, Rocket Raccoon is going to be the big breakout R2-D2, or whatever you want to call it, of this thing, and the whole world's going to fall in love. I don't think people expected to fall in love with Groot, with how well they did that. Every character was brilliantly done, but it's got a vibe. What I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, I know. I'm gonna back this up when because I think I know where you're going.
What did you know? People kind of sometimes piss and moan about you know, the Easter eggs and the post credits and. Gosh, does Nick Fury have to show up in everything and blah, blah, blah? To me, beyond giving a little tease and beyond saying there's more to come and, you know, take your $15 again, that to me is the essence of what it was like reading a comic book. And you get to the end of the comic book and it would say, well, you think that blew your mind. Wait till you see what happens next. But you have to go not to the next issue of Guardians, go to the next issue of She-Hulk, which will continue that story. And then when you'd finish with She-Hulk, it would be like, remember from last thing when this is, to me, that's the physical embodiment of them trying to emulate what happens in comic books. And it all came together in Guardians in a way that made me not for the first time, but probably the strongest feel like I was that kid, that 11, 12 year old kid reading a stack of comic books on a Saturday. And the vibe that it took was very 70s to me, late 70s. The soundtrack was outstanding.
Which only helps the 70s like, vibe. Yeah.
Oh, totally. It just didn't it feel like a 70s comic book to you?
Well, I got to be honest with you. I think Guardians is the best Star Wars movie we've had in 20 years.
Oh.
Like, I really felt like I went to see it on my own. My kids were away for the weekend, and I thought, you know what? I've had a rough month. I'm going to go see a movie and have a good time. And it's a freewheeling space adventure. It made me think, not maybe of Star Wars so much, but of there were a lot of, you know, kind of, you know, there's kind of a Buck Rogers-y Battlestar Galactica, you know, you got blue aliens and, you know, red aliens, and it's very colorful, and it just had this wonderful, optimistically, you know, fun vibe about it. And it did kind of take me back to being a kid again. You know,
yeah.
it was 1981 again. And
yeah.
I really enjoyed it, you know?
Oh yeah. No, you're right. It hits emotional notes. The comedy is great. Soundtrack, as we've discussed. You know what it is when you say Star Wars? And this has probably been talked about a billion times already, it had a Han Solo. What those prequels needed more than anything was a voice of cynicism. It needed someone who was, you know, fallible, that could look at the Force and go, I don't know what it's all about, but it's a bunch of hokum to me.
Yeah.
You know, I've been from one side. You know, everybody in those prequels is a stuffy frickin' Jedi.
Yeah.
Nobody, you know, the only loosey-goosey person you got was Jar Jar frickin' Binks. You needed a Han Solo desperately. And that was your lead guy. This was like a solo Han Solo adventure, kind of. Anyway, I loved it. I got all the toys. I got the guns. And I even have, from our mutual pal, William Frost over in the UK. It only took a couple of months to get here. If you look at the toys that Hasbro made for Guardians of the Galaxy, a Rocket Raccoon rifle blaster, Nerf blaster, is pictured on several bits of merchandise. Well, guess what? Never got released in the U.S.
No.
So
did they black marker over the back? You know, no.
It's on there. You can see it. It's like, yeah. People are going, where is this thing? Well, it never got released here, but our pal Frosty managed to track one down over in the UK. I think he ordered it through like a German site or something, and packed it up and shipped it off to me. It took ages because it's a sort of weapon. But I got it. Oh, yeah, I got it. So not only do I have Star-Lord's blaster, which looks pretty close to the Black Hole gun.
It does.
I got myself a Rocket Raccoon rifle, too. So
I agree, and that was on my list. And my runner-up would be Captain America the Winter Soldier, and here's my reasoning. One, Cap and Falcon are the ultimate 70s team-up. That's when I first discovered Captain America and Falcon.
God, that's what I had.
Yeah, and then second of all, you know, I'm sure Captain America and Falcon did a Watergate-type story where Captain America fell out of love with America. They updated it, but they put Robert Redford in the damn thing to tie it into all the President's Men. And well, that's just smart. And
for me, it's even more than that. Because if they would have been able to have made a mid-70s Captain America movie, big budget Superman Christopher Reeve type movie in 1975,
yeah,
Redford would have been Steve Rogers, period. He would have been the only name thrown out. He would have been the guy they would have thrown money at. And you probably would have had someone like Carl Weathers. I'm not trying to be funny. It would have been – imagine those two guys.
I think Jim Brown.
Jim Brown would have been great too.
Yeah.
Or you know who else? And I know I'm biased. Sam Jones. You know, Sam Jones. And Alex talks
as
about this
– as the Falcon? Too.
As the Red Skull. Oh. Sam Alex talks about this too in a very – non-homoerotic way, that is a couple of straight guys, that Sam Jones really is one of the best physical specimens that's ever been in a superhero movie ever. He just...
Yeah, he's got that jawline. I would argue that Kirk Allen... Kirk Allen, the first live-action Superman.
Oh, yeah.
Dude looks huge. You know
who else I think is always good as The Rock? Like, if you put, like, he's going to be Black Adam in the Shazam thing.
Yeah, he pulls me out of stuff, but I'm not against it. I just, you know.
But the thing that Winter Soldier was so great, that's number two on my list as well, because I remember them reading about how they were going to do this and how they want to make – the Marvel guys are obviously very, very bright at what they do and wanting to make the things feel different. You know, Thor 1 feeling different from Thor 2, but Thor 1 felt more Shakespearean. Let's get Kenneth Branagh. The first Captain America is a World War II film. What's the second one going to be? And one of the things that Cap and Falcon did – in those, because you were like me, that was my favorite comic book.
Yeah,
I read
me
it
too.
Like crazy. And it was, if you go back to those mid 70s stories, you know, Falcon's got his ear to the ground. He's a streetwise guy and he's the voice of modern, you know, dissent, basically. Cap, at this point, has been unfrozen for what, 7-8 years, whatever it's been, 10 years since the 60s. And he's looking around going, what happened to my country? Now you got Vietnam, Watergate. Gas prices sky high. This is all in the U.S. And he's questioning his patriotism, how this happened, what's going on. How do you can't – clearly we didn't make those movies in the 70s. So how do you do it now? How do you make that relevant to Cap now? And they did it brilliantly with,
they did brilliantly.
You know, the Patriot Act and spying. And
they put in Marvin Gaye.
Yes, yes, they put in Marvin Gaye.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, it was beautifully done. And it did feel like a mid-70s paranoid kind of thriller, like 3 Days of the Condor. And to get Redford, I mean, come on. Did you notice the we finally got Redford and Newman together one last time? Did you notice the cameo?
No, I didn't.
When he's in his house at night, saying goodbye to his housekeeper, and he opens the fridge, he's got a jar of Newman's own sauce in the fridge.
Oh yeah, I would never look for that. Poor Rosa.
Oh, I didn't. I had I caught it because I read about it. But okay. I love it. It's another one that I've watched several times. And you know what else too? A lot of practical effects. A lot of practical action in that film, and the action is fantastic. But
well,
just the fight sequences, they go on for days. I mean, they must have taken weeks to just do some of those fight sequences.
Well, that's the thing I wanted to bring up too, is that, I mean, Captain America's been on film now, you know, in the first film and the Avengers, and I've liked him in both, but this one really, it reminded me, there's an issue Jack Kirby does of Captain America where the Avengers Mansion is empty, and all these guys mob the Avengers Mansion because they want to get its secrets, and their reasoning is the only guy in there is Captain America. And these were always the best issues of Captain America, where he just takes down an army, and Kirby drew it in a way that you believed it. I mean, you know, he uses judo on this guy, and he moves in this kind of kinetic way. And this is the first time I've ever looked at it, something on screen and gone, yeah, I totally believe this. You know, this is how, you know, Captain America should move.
The elevator scene.
The elevator scene is brilliant. Yeah,
brilliant. But I gotta say, as long as you're on this topic, I am a huge fan of that man, Chris Evans.
Oh yeah, he's a good actor.
From the time he played, the first time he played Johnny Storm,
I thought he pulled that off.
Walked away with the movie, and I think he's one of these guys that's so good that people don't notice. Like, for the longest time, people took for granted, you know, guys like Redford and guys like Harrison Ford, just because what they did, they made it look so easy, they didn't quite realize what was behind it. And then you get someone like Brendan Fraser trying to do the same thing, and you go, oh, I don't buy it. And now I know why it's so impressive. Evans makes it look so easy. I don't think people – he's also for some reason just not out in front the way they praise, you know, Downey and you know, Thor and those guys. But I think he's fantastic, and I don't think he gets enough enough credit for just how good he is and how well he pulls it off.
He's nailing a character who's very humble.
Yes, and for the most part, Cap is kind of one-dimensional. He's not, you know, he's haunted by his past a bit, but, you know, great movie called Snowpiercer.
Yeah.
If anybody out there hasn't seen it, just great. And he did another one a couple years ago where he was a lawyer, but he was a junkie. And he played a I forget what the hell it was about, but he's a really good actor. I just think he's going to do lots of good stuff. But okay, we got to move on because we got shitloads to talk about. So how about TV? Can we go to like TV, either that's on or like a release of a show or something?
That's Blu-ray DVD. But yeah, we can do that. TV is usually running programs right now that kind of you feel and body a retro thing. I can start if you want.
Please.
The one I would choose because I enjoyed it is Toy Hunter. It got canceled this year. Now it got canceled because there was a change in management in the channel and they dumped a whole bunch of shows and changed the channel. The show was actually doing quite well. And the reason I know this is because the announcement of the cancellation came to me much earlier because the Toy Hunter crew was supposed to be here at my house filming. And the day before it happened, the show got axed. So we were filming a segment. I was supposed to film a segment with Jordan and Mark Huckabone, our friend. And
no.
I was just going to evaluate a toy. There was no hanky-panky of discovering something in my house. I didn't want to sell anything anyways. And I was, you know, going to get a good plug for my book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the axe fell. And then what happened was Mark still had a ticket to come to Toronto. So he came to Toronto. We hung out. We got a little drunk. And that was my weekend. And
I like it.
It was fun. It was a really fun time. I took the day off the next day.
Wow.
Yeah, well, I'm, you know, that boy can stay up. You know, and I just don't have
it. Does Huckabone have a hollow leg with the booze?
It's not so much the booze as it's time.
Oh, right.
He may have had two drinks for all I know.
Well, he's perpetually 12.
Yeah, well, kid, he just had his energy, and he's like infectious. Keanu Reeves. Yeah.
He doesn't age. He's like Keanu Reeves.
We barely got the kids to school. So I liked Toy Hunter, and let me defend why. Because a lot of people, it's controversial. Some people think he's ruining it. The reason I like it is that, for the most part, it's positive. You know, the second part is the guy's got to make a living, and he makes offers based on, I'm going to sell this. You know, I'm going to bring this to shows. And, yeah, they've put the formula of reality into it with what's in this box, you know. But that's, unfortunately, the trappings of even non-staged reality shows. But I think what I really liked about it was it spotlighted a lot of vintage toys that were kind of cool. You know, and yeah, to turn on a TV show and see vintage toys, and yeah, you know, I'm just kind of largely fond of it. I have the odd episode where I sit there and go, oh no, don't do that, you know, or that's not true, and I have another story I'll tell at another time about the show, but it's funny as hell. I got involved in another episode, but you wouldn't know. But I really liked it, and I wish it would return.
Well, you know, people are listening. It could happen.
Yeah, oh yeah, 7 or 8 people. The owner of the Travel Channel, I'm sure, is a subscriber on iTunes.
It's possible.
You never know. So that would be my pick for TV. My runner-up would be The Flash. I don't generally go for a lot of this weekly superhero stuff. I'm not a big Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. guy. I've seen Arrow a couple of times, never watched Smallville. But there's something about The Flash that kind of it works for me. And I'm surprised. It's a family affair in my house. And the thing I'm really surprised about is the credence it pays to the short-lived 90s series. There's been 3 or 4 cast members returned from that.
One of the episodes I saw had John Wesley Shipp in it.
Yeah, well, he's a semi-regular, but Amanda Pays has been on, and Mark Hamill is returning as the Trickster.
Is he?
He is. And I'm sure it'll be a more up-to-date, but I was trying to – because the Flash show came out when in my first year in college. And I remember it like it was the only thing ever on television at the time, you know, that was superhero related. And I occasionally had to fight for the common TV in my dorm. And, it wasn't great, but, you know, look how far we've come.
Sure. Actually, I think that I think that Flash series is better than we remember. I mean, I thought it was good, and the big thing, it was like a year after the first Batman, the Tim Burton Batman. So
they really borrowed heavy from that.
Yeah, including the theme, which was Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
But it's good. I mean, all things, you know, considered. What I love most about it is the guys that were sort of behind it and the main writers were Bilson and DeMeo.
Yeah,
they wrote the screenplay for The Rocketeer, which for my money is, you know, top 5 comic book films of all time.
Yeah, that's a very, very good adaptation. I agree with you on that.
It's Rocketeer's script is like a Swiss watch. Like every little corner is taken care of. And it's those guys, I'm almost positive those are the guys that were sort of behind The Flash. And they were pretty economical in their storytelling, if I recall.
Yeah, I mean, there's the odd time it looked like they just took an old Hulk script and, you know, scratched out Hulk and put Flash. But It's not bad. I just recently revisited it with my kids, and you've never had the pleasure of forcing a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old to watch the old series.
And what were their thoughts?
They were not thrilled.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted them to see the Trickster ones because I thought it'd be fun when the Trickster finally appears, and they like the new show very much. And yeah, it just didn't have the weight I thought it would. I guess it looks a little goofy to them now. I still say they got a lot right of that, but you know, they got a lot wrong too. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say if I'm gonna say Blu-ray, and I'm gonna say retro, and I'm gonna say TV, and I'm gonna say superhero, and I think you know where I'm going. Oh, sorry. Were you done?
No. I just clued in.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you want to switch to Blu-ray then, rather than that was current TV. We can just talk about Blu-ray release.
Oh, sorry. I thought it was like either or. My bad.
No. That, you know what? Do what you want to do.
Well, current TV wise, I gotta tell you,
don't watch a lot.
I tried with The Flash. I didn't love. I tried with Gotham. I did about 6 episodes, and it just.
I got 45 minutes into the first one.
I just felt like it was trying so hard, and I didn't like the names. I didn't like Jada Pinkett. I can't watch her anyway. I love that guy, Donald Logue, whatever, but I just thought he was trying so hard in this thing to be Bogart or I don't know what. I didn't like the guy playing Gordon, but then what? Two things that really started to get me. And you know what was crazy for you and I is seeing Sean Pertwee in a weekly TV series.
It is.
Sean Pertwee playing a character that has now been played by half a dozen other actors.
Yeah.
You know, and... God, put a wig on him and a
fan. Did you see his Halloween pictures?
No.
Where he went as his dad as Doctor Who?
No.
Oh, look him up.
Did you ever see the Peter Davison thing? The brilliant thing that Davison wrote and directed called The Nine Doctors or whatever it was?
Five-ish Doctors.
That was brilliant.
I saw that 2 or 3 times with the kids.
I thought that was outstanding. Yeah. Why that is not on DVD, I don't know. But he shows up in there in the beginning in a cameo.
Yeah, with what's her name from Broadchurch? I feel bad. I don't remember her name.
Yes, which I just watched the other day, right through.
I always actually kind of had a crush on her from the Mitchell and Webb show.
She's a great actor.
Olivia Colman.
Yeah. She can jump from comedy to drama. Better than just about anybody. She's terrific. But so Pertwee's the thing that makes me smile the most just because it's Sean Pertwee playing a heroic character. It's very cool. I don't like the kid. I don't like that he's this uber genius and he's trying to solve the world's crimes. But then they started to really play with mythology and timelines. And all of a sudden Harvey Dent shows up and he's like 10 years older than Bruce Wayne. And then there's the little girl playing Cap. I just wasn't interested. I know what they're trying to do, and I just
– It's not for me. I never am a prequel guy.
Yeah.
And it's – for me, I'd rather see a show that they were the cops and that worked in the aftermath of Batman. Like Batman is rarely featured.
Now that
– That's more now interesting.
Wasn't that initial like – Wasn't that that's the comic book, GCPD?
Yeah, I didn't think I invented it. But I would rather see a weekly series like that, which is, you know, like it's still got the problem of here are all the toys in the sandbox. You can't play with them. But, you know, I just to see the Penguin's origin or the Riddler's origin, it's just I don't see it. And I also find the show over the top and joyless. But this isn't, you know. To each
other. Sorry.
Yeah.
Let me go here then.
Okay.
Here it comes. This is a show that people have been pining for 20 years. Where is it? When is it? Why is it? How come we don't get it? Finally got released. The 1966 Batman TV series. Finally hit DVD. You can get it individual seasons. You can get it Blu-ray. You can get the seasons together. And I think you can finally get the big old giant box set which is what I got, which comes with a special book and the Hot Wheels 66 Batmobile.
Now that show's 50 years old now, almost.
50 years old.
And let me ask you this question: how much money do you think has been lost that in the 25 years that we've been wanting this merchandise?
Oh, millions.
Like, can you imagine, like, you would have had that show on, you first probably would have come out in some weird Columbia House deal.
Yes.
And then it would have come out on, you know, a huge box set of tapes. Yes. And then video disc, then laser disc, then DVD, then Blu-ray. Like, I can't wrap my mind around it. Now, I don't own the set because I'm supposed to be getting a comp one from Warner because I helped out with some of the films.
Oh yeah, that's right.
But I haven't seen it yet. The minute I buy it, it'll show up. So
let me just say that it's a hugely significant series, as everyone knows. Everybody loves the Batman series. And it's true. It's said in one of the documentaries, and it's been said many times, but it is true. People need to really understand this and grasp the world that existed in the 60s and how different it was, very much like it was for our growing up 70s, 80s. If you wanted to see the movie, you had to get to the theater to see it. It wasn't going to be on TV the next week or whatever it was. But truly, pop culture-wise, the 60s was the Beatles, Bond, and Batman. Now, Bond and the Beatles, you know, ruled the 60s. But for a brief time, Batman was thrown in there as well for a couple of years. What's extraordinary about it is how hugely, hugely popular the show was. I mean, just people were just ravenous. Kids, adults, everybody wanted to be in it. And just as quickly, they lost interest. And it was too much of a good thing. And, you know, a year later, it had, you know, half the viewing figures. But it is one of these things. It's a you know, special place in all of our hearts from growing up, watching this thing as kids and wanting it. You know, it's not the kind of thing that I can sit down and just watch 8 episodes in a row. It does start to wear thin. I don't know where the decision was made or how it went or why particularly. It's never really been explained to me why those in charge said, let's make it a comedy. There's no two ways about it. It is a comedy. It's got action.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's got action, it's got adventure, it's got some sexy stuff, but it is a comedy. There is not a word spoken by any character that is remotely serious. It puts the capital C in the word camp, like you wouldn't believe.
Well, I can tell you where it stems from because I've read up on this and I've seen it too. I'm sure I'll get emails correcting me on this, and then you're probably right. But I believe William Dozier. You know, there's a rumor that he read a comic, but I think that William Dozier was a friend of Hefner's, and Hefner would scream the old Batman serials. And I think at even one point, somebody had made the old Batman serials into a 2-hour compilation movie. And these things are goofy as crap. I saw them in the theater in the 80s with a girlfriend. And I just remember we were howling. They're just, you know, the guy playing Batman's kind of porky. Robin's 32. The Batmobile's just their car, and they change in the car.
I remember the ears being massive.
Yeah, right? and they're dorky and they're hilarious to an adult audience, but they're played straight faced.
Right.
So they really are. I think a lot of the sensibilities of that show stem from that old series, and they really are they're a riot. I mean, Riff Trax does installments of them. You can buy them for $1 with their commentary. They're really fun.
Well, to give it its due, it's gorgeous. I mean, the series is it's beautiful to look at.
Yeah, it's a lot of color. It's
the colors. Adam West is having the time of his life. There's a great shot in either the booklet or one of the documentaries, I forget, of him sitting next to William Shatner at the 1967 Emmy Awards. And it should be a poster. It's such a great – because it's like if there were ever two guys in the world of television that became synonymous with the character and their acting styles that, you know, they
are unique. Yeah.
It's totally unique and they couldn't shake off. So it's all those things. I'm glad it's finally out. I'm glad that I have it. When will I get through 3 seasons of this show? I don't know. It may take forever because it does kind of wear thin. There are literally like 700 episodes of the show.
Yeah. Well, it was on twice a week.
It was on twice a week. There's great character actors in the show, you know, Roddy McDowell. And
it's also a really sexy show.
It really is. I mean, I remember feeling tingly.
Yeah.
Way back when about Julie Newmar. Did I ever tell you once? I'd been out here a couple of years out in L.A., and I worked for this company where we did junkets for movies and things. And I went to a screening of a movie called To Wong Fu,
yeah.
Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar. And guess who I got to sit right next to?
Terrence Stamp.
I wish it was Terrence Stamp.
Yeah, that'd be really cool, actually.
Oh, I would have freaked if it was Terrence Stamp. But you're thinking of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which is a great film.
I am thinking of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I've never seen To Wong Fu.
I sat next to Julie Newmar throughout the entire film. And I turned to her before it started and I said something to the effect of, Ms. Newmar, it's such a thrill to be sitting next to you. I've had a crush on you for the longest time. And she turned to me and said, well, I hope I don't disappoint you tonight. Yeah, that was my Julie Newmar.
That was excellent.
And then she started mauling me, couldn't keep her hands off me throughout the whole film. And I said, Newmar, I'm sure. Come on, I'm trying to watch a movie.
You went too far. Yeah.
You slut, Julie.
I had a huge crush on Yvonne Craig. And I have more of an embarrassing story. I finally got her autograph, and I brought my son, who was a baby.
Mm.
And I was holding him because women like babies, and I thought I'd be able to talk to her a little bit. And nice. She cooed over him like crazy. And I think she wanted to hold him.
Oh.
But just as that happened, he had the biggest crap. We still call it the... You know, the Motor City Comic Con crap. And it filled the air, so I had to very quickly leave. She was very nice, and I think she figured out what was going on.
Very much like the first time you met her.
That's right. What's that?
Very much like the first time you met her. Like father, like son. It just happens.
Yes. Well, perhaps.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a fun show, you know. It's Batman, for crying out loud. But I will just say this one last thing about it. You know, it goes back and forth over the years the way people rip apart Tim Burton and what he did with those first two movies. I'm going to say this again, and I will shout it from the rooftops.
Please don't.
Everybody should get down on their knees, and bow to him, and. Those in charge, and maybe even that guy, what's his name, who's in every single Batman documentary, who seems to have penciled in his name as a producer, executive producer of every single Batman-related thing that's ever made from now until the end of time. The guy who got the whole ball sort of rolling, and his name escapes me.
Peters? But, is it like Goober?
No,
Peters?
Well, he was involved, but you know the guy. Uselin, Michael Uselin.
Oh, Michael Uselin. Yeah, okay. Yeah, he was a childhood fan, right? He used to write to DC, I think.
Yes, there is not – you cannot overstress just what it meant for that first Batman film to get made. And even though Frank Miller had done some things and, you know, Alan Moore was making a name for himself and things like Watchmen were out there and more serious books, it didn't mean that the public at large and your average Joe in Iowa – when they thought of Batman, they thought of anything other than this TV series.
Well, they actually, I just recently watched on YouTube a documentary that came out when Burton's film came out. Mm. I'm very nostalgic for 89. I was a young man at the time, you know, I have my ups and downs with that film. I just recently rewatched it, and it's got more comedy than I remembered, but it's still for the time. But one of the things is I think they interviewed John Peters, one of the producers, right. And it's really clear he has no clue.
Oh, yeah. No,
and he's going, well, we were trying to get Bill Murray for the longest time, but Tim insisted on Michael Keaton. And I'm like, wow, that puts Michael Keaton on a whole new level of competency.
And also, let's remember, I mean, you cannot overstress what a ticking time bomb this thing was. The Wall Street Journal on the front page were talking about the casting of Michael Keaton and how it could ruin Warner Brothers and the way the fans are freaking out. If the internet had existed, it would have melted the internet that Keaton was the guy. And I remember even at the time going, what? I loved Michael Keaton. I still do.
Yeah.
Loved everything. I just loved Michael Keaton. But I, you know, and I had seen Clean and Sober. You know, it was a great freaking movie. But I still kind of went, what are they? Think about it. Everybody was thinking the same thing, which was, where are they going with this? They're trying to get as far away from that show as they can. And this is who they cast?
My local comic shop had a still from Mr. Mom and a poster board that said, don't let Mr. Mom be Batman. Sign this petition.
Right? I remember an article. I remember Rolling Stone, cover of Rolling Stone, the Batman cover, and them profiling Keaton. And I remember the guy writing the article, and at some point, I mean, Keaton, they said Keaton was very subdued throughout and suspicious, you know, of the article. And then the guy finally goes, just for the record, I got to say, from the moment I heard you being cast, I thought it was a terrific idea. I can't wait to see what you're going to do. And Keaton goes, oh, yeah? Well, you're in the effing minority, man. I mean, he knew it the whole time. He knew that this thing was hanging over his head, and he had something to prove. But just to go back to this TV show, like it as beautiful as it is, and as much as we love it, and I love it as well, because probably Dino De Laurentiis probably said Flash Gordon, I wanted to be like the Batman. You who wrote the Batman? And he gets Lorenzo Semple Jr., who also wrote 3 Days of the Condor and some heavier stuff in the 70s, but he got Semple to do the script for Flash Gordon. So I've got a soft spot there. It did more damage to the character. It took 20 years to shake that off.
It did, but it also raised the profile of the character.
So oh, absolutely.
It's a really weird double-edged sword, you know? I mean, you could really argue, too, that the big superhero craze of the 70s, just like Star Trek syndication, was based on the Batman syndication. I mean, Mego's most popular lines, especially in the early 70s, were like the Batman, the Batmobile, the Batcave playset. These were huge. And I think, you know, along with things like the Super Friends and maybe the Wonder Woman TV series, you really the spark of the superhero blitz began with Batman and probably ended with like the Hulk.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
But no, that syndicated show,
it did a tremendous amount of good and merchandise and just love for the character and everything else. But for anyone wanting the character to be taken seriously, it did take a long time to shake that off. And it wasn't until, I go beyond Dark Knight Returns. It really was the Burton movie that did it, I think.
Oh, I think so. I agree with you.
And then within 4 movies, it's right back to square one with Schumacher. He made the 66 TV series all over again with Clooney, which is
what's funny is I don't want to get on too much of this, but I just watched Batman and Robin the other day because it was just on.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, what the hell, right?
Yeah, what the hell.
And I can't believe how much The Amazing Spider-Man 2 has in common with that movie. You have a major star in cringy blue makeup making bad puns.
Oh, my God.
You got another actor in this awful green makeup being obnoxious, you know, the Green Goblin Uma Thurman thing. And, you know, the bane of the movie is the Rhino. And it's
– oh, my God.
I did not enjoy that film. And
I'm not sure I finished that movie.
I didn't finish it, actually. I couldn't finish it.
It's
a remake. Skills. When I saw that German doctor in the
that
hospital –
that was when the skills got tipped.
I was like, did Joel Schumacher write this?
God, you know? Like, yes, let me have some time this patron.
I'm Dr. Stereotyping.
Suddenly he's like Scrooge McDuck. Yeah. Shows up and is like, oh, it straightens me out like a pretzel. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was
what the hell? What happened?
So, and you know, they, you know, it was so, you know, out of
clean. They're gonna wipe it clean. They're gonna dump Garfield and they're gonna start from scratch. And it's rumored, but I'm telling you, it's gonna happen. He's gonna show up in either Age of Ultron or the next one or whatever, and you know, hang out with the Avengers for a bit, and they're gonna revamp the whole thing.
Let's hope Wallace Shawn gets his due.
God, why can't we stay on topic?
I don't know. Let's move on. Let's move on quickly. I'll run through my releases right now. Number one Blu-ray for me this year was Phantom of the Paradise.
Yes.
This is a film that I've been a fan of for a long time, ever since I was a kid. It has not always gotten its due.
Garrett Graham.
But thanks to some influential people, mostly Guillermo del Toro, this thing is packed with extras. There's stuff I hadn't seen before. How about
him reading the liner notes?
Oh my God! Even the reversible cover, so you could use the poster or this new artwork.
And Beef peeks through.
Yes, and there was deleted scenes I hadn't seen before. I let my daughter watch it with me, and she loved
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah, I thought, what the hell? She kind of likes horror. And, you know, not that we watched The Walking Dead with her, but, you know, this seemed like it was okay. And she really loved it. She felt sorry for Winslow at the end. But this was a love letter, and I'm absolutely appreciative of it. And it there's a few more films on my Blu-ray list, you know, things like Logan's Run and The Omega Man that I know Del Toro is a fan of as well. And I hope that they get this kind of same treatment.
And you know what else? Those of you that haven't seen the documentary, Is Paul Williams Dead or Paul Williams, whatever it is, remind you of how significant Paul Williams was,
what
genius he is.
Still,
and how prominent he was in the 70s. It's just if you haven't seen it, dig it. It's great. I love it too.
My follow-up isn't necessarily a Blu-ray or a DVD, but I have two things I wanted to mention. One is something that I didn't get to at the last year's Retro Awards, but because we didn't have it, and that is Dr. Shocker's Vault of Horror. Daniel Roebuck put together this amazing little documentary about monster toy collectors. It is narrated by Jorge Garcia, I believe he's Hugo from Lost.
Okay.
Of which you have made an action figure of. And I was sadly supposed to be in this. My video camera was so bad they couldn't use my footage. But at the end of the credits, there's a lovely plug for Rack Toys, which was really nice. I know Daniel wrote me once and said, I love your book. I carry it around. And when I'm eating lunch by myself, I read it. And I thought it was really nice of him to say, but he even though he didn't use any of my footage, he plugged the book, which I was really appreciative of, and he didn't have to do that. The second thing I wanted to talk about was I'm a huge fan of Riff Trax, and that, if you're not familiar with it, is three former guys from the last incarnation of Mystery Science Theater, and that is your pal, Mike Nelson. Sorry, that should have been quicker. Kevin Murphy and Bill Corbett, mm-hmm. who were the Sci-Fi Channel, Mike, Crow, and Tom. And they have done these online streaming movies for a couple of years now, and they have been picking some real gems from the 70s. And this couldn't have happened at a better time. It happened at a real low point in my life, and they released this movie called The Guy from Harlem. And it's a 70s blaxploitation film. It looks like it's filmed in, like, Tampa. And the film alone is a masterpiece of shoddy filmmaking, and you – for a while there, when you're watching it, you kind of think, is this a comedy Bang Bang skit? Because it's almost genius. You know, like, but then combined with the Riff Trax, it really brightened my spirits at the time. I mean, there's just, you know, the fight scenes at one point, I think Mike compares them to, you know, choreography by 2 7-year-olds in their aunt's basement, you know. I I heartily recommend you seek out The Guy from Harlem. It is
okay.
Really funny. And they also did a short called This is Hormel, which has become a family event here. And Hormel. This is Hormel, you know, like the rendering plant. Yeah. So two kids in, like, I guess the late 50s, early 60s, write to the meat company and get a tour. And what they see is horrific. You know the old expression, never find out how sausage is made? This is it. And it, like, my kids were both grossed out and horrified, but just would not let me turn it off. I mean, you just, it's just terrifying. And also just, and I think it honestly costs like $1 or $2 to buy it.
Okay.
So you just download it, and it is well worth the money. So those are my choices for releases this year. It's a weird, you know, you've chosen obviously probably the biggest one
what?
In Batman 66, but biggest.
Yeah.
I think the most people would agree with you. I just want a little more weird as I'm wont to. So,
as is your
my thing. Yes.
Let me do this then.
Yeah.
Are you still hearing me?
I hear you fine.
So we can, as long as we're on this. Okay. So we did the Blu-ray. We got Phantom. I guess I can throw this in, similar, but it's kind of retro-y because I wanted to talk about another release that's like a reissue that really meant a lot to me. As most people know, I'm a huge fan of Monty Python. I love those guys. They all, you know, got together in July to do a series of 10 live shows in London at the O2 Arena. And they put out a DVD and CD set to go with it, with a bit of a booklet. It's called Monty Python Live, Mostly, One Down, Five to Go, referring, of course, to the death of Graham Chapman. But in addition, and I think this might have been UK only, or maybe it's finally out in the US, they reissued the bulk of their albums, their comedy albums from the 70s on CD. And it's a box set called Monty Python's Total Rubbish, the complete collection. Comes with a big hardcover book that talks about each record and then all the CDs. And this was a big deal for me because I collected all the Python stuff. The albums were seminal stuff for me in the 80s and put them all into cassette. And
The record stuck.
I mean, they were as brilliant on vinyl as they were on television because they kept bending the rules and played with the medium. Most significantly, this is the truth, because we didn't have the internet to figure this stuff out, and I was one of those people that thought they were going insane. They made the world's first three-sided record. The fourth or fifth record they did was called Monty Python's Matching Tie and Handkerchief, and the inner label of both sides, I think, said Side A. So it just said, it's the name of the album, and it said Side A. One side of the album, when you put the needle down, it played, you know, for 20-some minutes from the outer edge to the inner edge, and you were done. When you flip the album, you put the needle down, and you let it just play to the middle, you got 12 or 15 minutes of material. If you put the needle back to the start but put it on the very next groove, you got 12 or 15 minutes of completely different material.
Weird.
It was genius. But what it did was, when I tried making cassettes of different sketches, I kept trying to put the needle down, and I'd put it down to get to this particular sketch, and it kept going someplace else. I thought I was going mad. And I finally figured it out on my own. But that's what it did. It was Terry Jones' idea to make this thing. Just things like that that they did that were so significant, and loads of material that was only on record that never made it into film or any of their television shows. I've had it on vinyl. I've had it on reissued CD. I had some on cassette when I went to London once and couldn't find them in the U.S. And now I've got them all on – oh, by the way, and all the CDs are the deluxe reissues with loads of bonus tracks and things like that. So it's very cool to finally have that, and to have the live shows from July, which is very bittersweet to see them all together again, and kind of sad too, because they, you know, they're all in their early to mid 70s, and it's very much looking like Terry Jones is kind of getting some form of dementia, which is sad. But that was a big deal for me as a reissue and as a big fan of theirs. So it's very cool if you're into those guys to pick that up. And also, I think I've talked about this before, probably not here. Small Faces, one of my favorite groups. We just lost Ian McLaughlin, who was the keyboard player for the Small Faces and the Faces. There's only one face left, which is Kenny Jones. They were the seminal mod group of the 60s, Great Britain. They put out a beautiful, beautiful box set with a great header card signed actually by Ian and Kenny, which is very cool to have now. And I became friends with Ian for a while trying to get a movie made. But it's called Here Come the Nice. It's a beautiful box set, loads of material that hadn't been heard before in different forms, and that was a big deal for me as well to get that as a piece of music to have more of their stuff. And anytime I can shout about the Small Faces to the world to tell them to go seek them out, any chance I can, I do, because I love them. So. Oh, there you go. Back to you. What else you got? We should wrap this up because you just talk too much.
I know. I'm a chatterbox tonight. Ooh, I don't know what you're doing, but I can hear my voice reverberating. I think it's gone.
Me?
No, I can hear it now. I can't hear it anymore. So, all right, let's go through our last three categories.
Okay.
Books. I don't read a lot. Mostly menus. But... there was two books that I wanted to mention. One is a beautiful hardback book that I got called Planet of the Apes, The Evolution of the Legend. I love getting giant books for Christmas.
Mm.
This is a beautiful, beautiful, nice, glossy photographed book about Planet of the Apes that has lots of reading in it. I haven't quite finished it. One thing I really love about it is, yeah, it talks about the new films, mm-hmm. but it does not – it is not like one of those – you know, sometimes you pick up a Dorling Kindersley book and it says, you know, Batman, and it's all about Christian Bale, and there's one page that shows Adam West, and you go, this is kind of, you know, I kind of want more of a tomb here. This doesn't miss a beat. It talks about the Burton films. It talks about the new films, but it's very even-handed. And if you're a Planet of the Apes film, whatever incarnation – you'll enjoy this. Number two is a book that has been out for a couple of years, but bear with me. I just got it. It is called Mail Order Mysteries, Real Stuff from Old Comic Book Ads by Kirk DeMarais.
Ooh, this sounds cool.
The reason I didn't look at this book was I was writing Rack Toys when it got released, and I was pretty close to pressing send, and I just didn't want to, A, find out that it was very similar to what I was doing and, you know, kind of kibosh my energy, or that it was B, way, way better and I should just quit, or C, I didn't want to steal anything from this guy. You know, how you read something and you don't want to get influenced. So I just avoided it. But, you know, 2 years into Rack Toys, I'm pretty sure I'm safe now. And I had been talking to, not to name drop, but I'd been talking to Joel Hodgson, and he mentioned the book to me.
Okay.
And I thought, you know, I really need to get this book. And it was given to me for Christmas. And, you know, when it came, when I opened it, my wife said, "That's a really great book. I read it." So she read the whole thing before she gave it to me. And so did my daughter. I'm sure I'm the last guy on the planet to talk about this book, but basically it takes the old comic book ad, you know, the Count Dante, Kung Fu, or the Sea Monkeys, shows you what you got and evaluates it. Brilliant, beautiful to look at. I highly recommend it. Best $20 you've ever spent.
Wow, that is an endorsement. Please put a link up. I want to get that.
Yeah, I will. Again, it's not new. It's a 3-year-old book, but I had been avoiding it for good reason and probably too long. I should have bought it after my book came out, but and I'm really glad I bought it. I couldn't put it down. So that's all my reading. Other than you go.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Mr. Hyla.
Can you hear me?
You've faded in and out there, Hyla.
I'm not fading. I sound great.
No, you sound very quiet.
Really?
Well, now I can hear you just fine.
Okay. Okay, yell.
Okay. okay, so that was the book. That sounds great.
Those are my books. What are your books? Got books?
There's one called Green Eggs and Ham.
Oh, that's new.
I haven't got to the ending yet, so don't say anything.
He goes for it.
Well, all I was going to say, because I got to tell you, I haven't done a lot in the way of books lately.
Not for books and such.
I really should do more and learn to read more. But what I did pick up, I think you'll be very happy and proud of, is a little thing called the Doctor Who Annual 2015.
No kidding. They did that again?
What do you think of those apples? Yes. It is paper thin. You know, it's like 40 pages, all written by the same guy. And very much aimed at a younger audience. I don't remember the annuals being this young, but I've been getting nostalgic for these annuals lately. You've seen, I picked up a couple of ones from the 70s. You and I are morbidly fascinated.
The artwork is almost nightmare fuel sometimes.
Absolutely mental artwork in the 70s.
And they just use like myriads of brown with more brown and a bad picture of Tom Baker, and it's
just
what were you, did you not like children? What is this?
Kids didn't put this thing down and want to kill themselves after reading it. I do not know. This one's a bit more fun. The 70s ones are just crazy because they just
– Well, I find they went like completely inconsistent. Like sometimes you just have this mad artwork and beautiful comic strips, and then the next year it'd be just like, well, this guy's off his meds. Let him paint, you know?
Yes. It totally – well, it's the definition of like, you know, do they have any reference? Could we have any reference pictures? Oh, here, there's three. Here's three, and here's 17 photos from different movies that he might have been in.
The worst one I've ever seen is the Tom Baker, Peter Davison mashup one, where they don't know what Davison's going to wear. All they have is a headshot of him, and it's on the cover. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay. It's on the cover. So there's a there's Tom Baker and a headshot of Peter Davison. And then inside is a drawing of Tom Baker. And in the back is a drawing of Peter Davison. That's the headshot. And I think it permeates. There's a pretty decent comic strip. And then the Peter Davison story at the end again uses that drawing of Peter Davison's head.
It's so because we talk about Doctor Who was a beloved show. It did get big numbers. People watched it. There were kids. There was nothing in the way of merchandise, but maybe a frickin' pencil case and a bookmark all year. And the one thing the kids waited for was the annual, which I never understood even what annual meant.
See, we got them in Canada. I have Logan's Run, Planet of the Apes, and they're brilliant.
It's just, you know, I've got a Star Trek one from 76 that you open it up. The inside cover artwork is the most insanely mental shit you've ever seen.
And aren't they mostly like gold key? Because I got a bunch of those.
No, it's different. It's original artwork. But the Doctor Who stuff, the artwork is always at a special place. Like the 60s stuff looks good. When it gets into the 70s, especially Tom Baker stuff, it is suicide inspiring. It's just weird, but here it is again. They're doing it again, and it's just great to see Peter Capaldi on the front.
I got
to
seek that out because
it's kind of fun, and it also pays a bit of credence to the history of the show because it does a good job of introducing kids to previous doctors and such. We got to get to toys, and then we're going to have to wrap this up.
Okay, I'm just going to quickly mention magazines. Again, every year I give the award to the same magazine I read, which is Shock Cinema. This is a brilliant magazine for a cinephile. They tend to work on exploitation film, but they do a lot of foreign. I always end up circling stuff. I used to be a huge Psychotronic Encyclopedia film reader. Now Shock Cinema fills that void for me quite nicely. And this month's issue is got an in-depth interview with Richard Anderson, among other people. John Doe's interviewed as well. They never mention the $6 million man because Anderson is a cinephile and they figure everyone talks to him about Oscar Goldman. Let's not. And that's why I like Shock Cinema. So
nice.
Let's move on to toys.
Is that the one? What was the other one? Shock Cinema. Video Watchdog.
Video Watchdog is great. I just can't seem to get it around here.
Is it still going?
You're asking a guy who lives in the suburbs, and there's one bookstore that carries Shock Cinema in a chain. The other ones don't, so I have to drive like two towns over to get it. So, yeah, and I like buying it at the newsstand. I'm weird that way.
magazine-wise, a couple of magazines I always get, Q, British music magazine, Mojo is another British music magazine, and Empire, which is a movie magazine that I've been getting since it came out in 89. It's still kicking. I love magazines. I always have. I read them from cover to cover. I hope they never go away, and they are a dying art form. But I love them because you can take them with you and you can read them at night and whatever. Empire's still doing great stuff. They clearly are still madly in love with movies. There's another great magazine that's a little pricey, but it's done by an old pal of mine called Lee Pfeiffer, who was an old Bond collecting buddy of mine, and I've known him for literally 25 years. And it's called Cinema Retro.
Oh, I've seen that.
Great articles on movies of the 60s and 70s. They even did a lot of Bond stuff, a lot of Beatles, Man from U.N.C.L.E. They're big fans of all that stuff, and it's a really well done magazine. It's homegrown and a little pricey, but it's really nice nice articles, cover to cover, beautiful pictures.
I at least have one issue of that. I really liked it.
Yeah, let's get to toys because I got like a
you know what we should this is a great way to end. So let's go through toys. I've got five. How many have you got?
I got three.
It's embarrassing that we have more toys than books, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Because you don't have to read them. You can just look at them.
To be fair, I've read a lot of books this year. Just none of them fit into this. So.
Well, what do you got for – give me your toys.
All right. I'm holding the one I really liked this year, and it just came. But I did – it came out earlier, but it got lost in the mail, which is the Funko. The NECA Planet of the Apes Taylor. Finally got a Mego-style Taylor.
Yeah,
I'm fond of it. It comes with the lovely backpack and his, his astronaut outfit, and I can stand him next to my Mego Dr. Zaius. And Mego did an astronaut that was fairly generic.
Dr. Zaius.
And this was Dr. Zaius. Mego didn't have the rights to Charlton Heston, so they pretty much gussied up a generic guy. There's a lot of controversy as to where the head sculpt came from.
Oh.
Yeah. Welcome to the Mego world. This is very, very nice to have an 8-inch Taylor. So that would be one of my five.
I know how long you've waited for an 8-inch Taylor.
That's right. I really walked into that, didn't I?
You really did. Yeah. I'm sorry. You just set them up and I knock them down.
Yep.
I got three. One of them is again back to Batman. NECA. First, let me just say that Mattel did something very groovy, which they got a lot of shit for it, and I'm really tired of it. But they did a 4-inch line of action figures from the DC movie universe. They made a Christopher Reeve Superman, for God's sake. They made a Terrence Stamp General Zod. They made a Danny DeVito Penguin, a Michelle Pfeiffer Catwoman, a Michael Keaton Batman, masked and unmasked. And yep. Are they perfect? No, but I love them. And I love that I've got...
I never buy new toys. I have the Zod and Superman on my shelf because it's like, oh my God, Terrence Stamp, and it's $10, and I bought it.
And we've got Superman and Batman together on the same shelf. I think it's brilliant. But NECA took it one step further, and they made a 6-inch Michael Keaton Batman from the Batman video game that Nintendo made back in 89 with those video game colors, which is still a beautiful figure. I love it.
It's kind of purple, didn't they just put him in a Blu-ray as well and you could get the actual color correct?
Yes, it's color correct. It's on a card. Looks very much like Toy Biz back in 89. They said they weren't going to do it, but they did when you get it with the Batman Blu-ray. So that's out there. It's a gorgeous sculpt, long overdue, one of those things you just go, oh, like you just said with Taylor, I finally got a Keaton Batman. What's your next one?
My next one, I can't believe I have to look at a list, is Funko did the Universal Monsters in 3 3/4 inch.
Yes, they did.
They unleashed an onslaught of 3 3/4 inch figures. Some were, I thought were great, and some were kind of heh, but I didn't really care for the subject matter either. Like, I'm not a big Terminator or Predator guy, so I don't care.
Right.
But I do care about the Universal Monsters, and I got a set of those in. I was going to, they had me at hello.
Right.
And they are excellent. They're a lot of fun. They're very reminiscent of the Remco. They did glow variants. They did a clear Invisible Man through Entertainment Earth.
Did they do glow variants? I didn't know that.
Yeah, they did a glow creature, glow mummy, and they just kind of showed up laissez-faire. I actually found some retail. I loved it. I love it. I don't care if they make more characters, but I thought that was great. That was really
cool. Those are fun. I caved in and picked some of those up as well.
I didn't buy any of the other stuff they did. Next year looks like I might have some problems.
I got another one. Back to NECA, who it's just, you know, I like NECA.
Yeah.
But they were the guys way back in the day that if they made an action figure, they got a license. You were lucky if you got 4 points of articulation.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Not only are their sculpts really, you know, out of the park, the articulation is great, too. And they've done a lot with Terminator, a lot with Aliens, and, you know, variations of those titles. The last wave of Alien, Aliens, they did like an Alien 3 Alien. They did Bishop from Aliens. And they made Kane from Alien. Now, it's not it's not a sculpt of John Hurt because he's got the face hugger on him. So you can have the face hugger on without the outer plastic shell of the helmet, or you can put the helmet on, which has it's like burned through a hole in the front where the face hugger went. But it's a gorgeous figure, even though it's not his face sculpt, because of that damn suit, that Mobius space suit, those beautiful suits that were done for the first. I am madly in love with the first Alien. I like Aliens, but the first Alien, you could put it on any day of the week and I would sit and watch the thing. So that's really cool to finally have that figure, because any minute now, we're finally going to get a Sigourney Weaver sculpt of Ripley from the first film, which we've never, ever, ever gotten. So that's right around the corner, and I can't wait. So that's my next pick, I would say. There's probably more stuff, but I'm just going to limit it to three, and I'll let you take the next one.
Okay, yeah, it would be the Biff Bang Pow. I'm going to mention Biff Bang Pow, even the elephant in the room. This came out just at the end of 2013, early 2014. I probably got it in 2014, is the Dalek. You guys made.
Oh man, you beat
Who. Brilliant. I cannot tell you, that is the best Dalek toy I own. And you know, I mean, there's some people like talking and all that, but this is the 8-inch Mego Dalek that I have always wanted.
Dude, you beat me to it. And I'm going to toot my own horn, which I rarely do, and I probably should more often, or maybe not. Maybe it makes me a dick. But it came out end of last year. I think I finally got my hands on it at the very beginning of 2014. It is the final bit of action figure merchandise we were able to do with the Doctor Who license. My intent was to do much, much more, obviously.
Yeah.
We had plans for all the Doctors, you know, in the 8-inch form and all kinds of things. But one of the things I wanted to start with, and I said from the beginning, was this was going to be the toy line that had it existed in the U.S., this is what I would have gone to the toy store to get back in 79. And also to try to emulate what Dennis Fisher did in the U.K., which were 10-inch figures, which some people I think know, not 8-inch. So the world never got 8-inch Doctor Who figures. And that lineup was the Doctor, Leela, Giant Robot, Cyberman, K-9, Dalek, and the TARDIS. And other than the Giant Robot, which I got from you last year, 2 years ago, I finally got a loose Giant Robot. We hit all the characters. We made K-9 as an exclusive with Think Geek. We made the fold-out TARDIS, the Tom Baker, obviously the Leela, the Cyberman, which is actually the Cyber Leader, and the Dalek finally. It took forever, but that Dalek, if they bury me tomorrow, that's going to be one of the things I want to be buried with, because it is probably – it's easily my favorite, proudest Doctor Who moment of what Biff Bang Pow did. But it's got to be in my top five of all the merchandise that Biff Bang Pow has ever made. That is in my top five. It might be my favorite because
– It really is.
It's everything I wanted it to be and more, and I'm just in love with it.
Yeah, I've got it looming over me right now, and it kind of reminds me of those great Sevens model kits that used to come out, but I could never build professionally.
Yes, the one that sat in a box for 10 years.
Yeah, and it was beautiful. It really is great. I own a couple actually.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. No, that's because you know, Character Options has done some great you know, 6-inch talking ones. And what they did recently, now they're doing the 4-inch scale. They put out a new Peter Capaldi, a Matt Smith, you know, Amy and people like that. But they did a gold Dalek and the Genesis of the Daleks Dalek, which is what that was. I mean, I wanted it to be the Genesis Dalek because that's my – that's when I think Doctor Who, I go right to Genesis those days watching it, you know, after school. And it's just cool that particular design – whenever I'd see other pictures of Daleks, it didn't make sense to me because that's the color scheme that I knew and loved because of Genesis of the Daleks. That's what I thought Daleks were, and they always should be. I'm just in love with it. So thank you for putting it on the list, and I don't care how I sound, I'm in love with it.
Yeah, no, it's a great piece, and I can't not say it. So, and thanks, man. What's your next one?
That's it. That's all I got.
Oh, you got the Dalek? Okay, I got two more. And one of them is controversial. The other one is you again. The first one is Lucifer from Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
I've always just kind of been obsessed with that character. The Mattel figure's, you know, pretty much just a stick. So it's kind of cool to have. I like robots, and Mego, there's not a lot of robotic Mego characters.
And you're a big fan of Jonathan Harris.
I am. I thought, was he the voice of it all the time?
Yeah.
Oh, really, eh? Look
Bob
at that.
Wolfman.
I learned something. I'm a huge fan, and that figure came in, and I'm not the world's biggest Battlestar Galactica guy, but I know what I like, and I've always thought that character was interesting, and I love having him in 8-inch format. My last one, and this one's – the movie stank, okay? I did not enjoy Anchorman 2.
It's a bummer because I love the first one.
I adore the first one, and there's so much in there that works. And I don't know how – maybe it hit me in the wrong frame of mind, but I just did not enjoy Anchorman 2.
Right.
And, you know, I'm meaning to give it another shot, but the Beeline Creative line of toys, when I first saw them, I was like, I'm not going to buy any of these. I own all of them.
Yeah, they did a nice job, didn't they?
Well, it's a weird job. Now, they did a 12-inch Ron Burgundy that has Scotch vision, like Steve Austin, and you look through his eye.
Yes.
I had that before I realized why. And then they released an 8-inch Ron Burgundy, which isn't bad. He's kind of on a weird body, but not bad for – they've got them yelling, and at first I didn't like it, and then I kind of grew it. And I had pre-ordered the Paul Rudd, Brian Fontana character, and a couple of the others, and I thought, well, I'll never see these. These will get canceled.
Right.
And then they just showed up one day, which shocked me. And I don't know what it is about them. I mean, on paper, I was kind of like, eh. And then when I got them in my hands, they're just as amusing as the first movie was.
Right. The movie, that's the great thing about that movie is it didn't take the world by storm. It's one of those – it's like a Lebowski. It sort of grows on you.
And, even the first Austin Powers wasn't a hit.
No.
It hit video, really.
No, that was the gift of video. People forget that, but it that's where the audience came from.
Well, I saw it on opening night, and boy, I could tell the audience wasn't there.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater like opening weekend, and I was laughing to myself.
Yeah.
You got one more? Is that it?
That's it for me. I'm done.
That's a great show. God, I love this show.
Yeah, me too. We should.
If I wasn't on it, I'd listen to it.
I'd watch it more often, yeah.
I'd watch it more often. Nice stuff there, Hyler. Thanks for how long we've been doing this? Like 17, 18
this
years?
I think this is our anniversary. I think it's our 2-year anniversary, which is what, mud?
I think it's mud.
I'll get you some mud. Yeah.
It's mud or sausage.
No, you know what it is? It's Hudson Brothers.
So, Hudson Brothers.
Yeah, your second year anniversary, you got to give some Hudson Brothers. And that's exactly what I'll do, but I will not accept one in return.
You know what's funny is I associate – and I always get them slightly mixed up, but I associate the Hudson Brothers with the Croft Super Show.
They are very different things.
They're very different things, but it was right around the same time that they aired on Saturday mornings. And they've got to be some of my very, very, very earliest – TV memories, because that Croft Super Show with what was the band called, like Super Turkey and
that was Captain Cool and the Kongs.
Captain Cool and the Kongs. That has got to be one of my very, very earliest TV memories.
For some reason I really remember that well. Like I think again, Electro Woman and Dyna Girl This is probably a show. I think the
director. We should do a Sid and Marty Krofft show.
We could do a two-parter on that one. I love Sid and Marty Krofft.
But no, but the captain, cool. That is the bunch of middle-aged guys in a room going, "How can we make this band? What are they gonna be like? How are they gonna talk? What are they gonna?" Trying to think about how kids, and it was dated. The moment they started to film, it was dated in 5 minutes. It was
I think in the second season, the Captain Cool went from wearing like glittery denim, and then or something, and then they discoed them up for the second season, and that looked old.
And just the fact that they called one of the characters was called Turkey.
Turkey, and in fact, I think I've done the coloring book for that on Coloring Book
Theater.
Yes,
you have.
And there's just one page that's Turkey eats a sandwich. That's brilliant.
Quick side note, I saw your Battlestar Galactica coloring book theater.
I thought of you.
It's got to be the same artist as the Buck Rogers one. It's got to be.
Tony Tallarico. But, well, that guy has done some beautiful work. This isn't it.
He made the Cylon with, like, the Iron Cross for a face.
Like somebody, I put some theories on there as to what that is, and somebody wrote back and said, "Theory number four, he did it on the bus on the way there." And you know what? That's pretty solid.
See, that's the fun thing about everything that we're talking about. Most of the shit, the retro shit that we talk about, nobody was sitting in a room designing a figure back in '74 thinking anybody would be talking about it in a year's time.
That's the joy of this.
That's the joy of it. And the whole notion of a rack toy that, you know, imagine meeting somebody from one of those companies 40 years later and he picks it up and goes, "This isn't opened?" Like, it was supposed to be opened and thrown away in like 2 days. And people, you know, we're talking about this stuff. It's a very strange world, you know, and coloring books and none of this stuff. Now, you look at stuff now. We're even guilty of it sometimes, where even on the packaging, it'll say, you know, official licensed product or collectors, you know, or whatever it is, thinking that there's an audience there. But most of the stuff we talk about, no one could have possibly imagined we'd be. Well, you know, there was another show or something, might have been Doctor Who or some other, maybe I forget what it was, but it was one of those like close-ups of a panel or a floor paneling or something. It was so vivid on the DVD or the show, whatever it was on. It was so vivid you could almost literally smell the paint drying on this thing. But imagine the time constraints and the budget and everything else. And no one was sitting there thinking in 50 years' time they're going to be freeze framing this thing and looking at our work.
Well, you know what? 20 years – or about – No, sorry, not 20 years ago. About 8 or 9 years ago, I was working on a SpongeBob project, and it was a rack toy, and the printing molds came to me back from the factory, and you know we had done I think a couple hundred thousand of these things, and they said you can just throw these out; they're worn out, and it was basically this rubber mold of SpongeBob and Patrick, and I was sitting there like gonna chuck it out, and then I was thinking, what if weirdly, because, you know, working in the Amiga Museum, I get a call because I was the director of the design at the time. And what if I get a call and somebody collects these things?
Yeah.
Am I going to, you know, because not that I'd sell it, but I'd probably give it to anyone who sought me out, you know, or tell them any weird secrets, you know. Not, it sounds egotistical, but you never know. Most of the people I tracked down at Mego were kind of like, I can't believe someone cares, you know?
Yeah. No, so. it's been I don't know what that says about us. I don't know why we're sort of fascinated with minutiae like that. I don't know. But anyway, I hope everybody's enjoyed this, and I hope that it's odd to think that we talk about things that people might actually care about or go out and discover because we've talked about it. But if that is the case, I hope you try some of this stuff and you dig it, and just be thankful that this show isn't called, you know, Illegal Substances of the Week, because we could be turning you on to all the wrong kind of stuff.
And I would have to hide under a desk.
Yes, exactly. More than you do already.
Yeah, I don't go well with illegal substances. They don't bring out the best in me.
So there you go, everybody. Happy New Year. Happy 2015. Get out and try, you know, dip your toes into some different pools here. And as always, thanks for listening, because we don't exist if you don't listen, if that makes sense.
Sort of.
Kind of.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.